On a hill in rural France, the mighty Tietval Memorial towers over the northern section of the Somme battlefield. You can see it from miles away, and that was the intention of Edwin Lichens, the architect that designed it all those years ago. That's why he chose that location. And whenever I go to the Somme, I often find myself confused as to where I am. Caught up in the stories I'm telling, I turn around and think I'm looking north, I'm in fact looking east or west. So what do? I always look for that memorial as a marker. It's never far away. As I said, towering over the battlefield with its 72,000 stories. And if you go to the back of the memorial, up the steps, at the front, past the Stone of Remembrance, and down the steps to the right, you'll see a panel, an addendum they called it. And on that panel are the lists of men whose names were added after the main structure of the memorial had been built in the 1930s. And on there, the first name you'll see on panel one, addenda panel one, the name of Hugh Henschel Clifford Williamson, a lieutenant in the 1st Battalion of the Coldstream Guards. He was 21 years old when he died on the 15th of September 1916. But why is his name there? Why is it not in the main structure with the rest of the Coldstream Guards? Well, the answer is a very complicated and controversial and perhaps upsetting story. It's certainly not straightforward. It never is it? 250 miles away, beneath a tree in the small Northamptonshire town of Wellingborough, another victim of the Somme is now at rest, and he's finally received a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone above his final resting place. Only recently has this wrong been corrected. And only a few miles away, in the county town of Northampton, there's another brand new headstone that's been erected above another man whose short time in the army was forgotten about until it was discovered a few months ago, and he also has a brand new Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone above his final resting place. And then out on the Western Front again, near Neuve Chapelle, there's a cemetery called Windy Corner. And last week, a former school teacher who played football for Bolton Wanderers Football Club, he was finally laid to rest along with two unknown soldiers 110 years after he died. It took decades, more than 10 decades for one of them, for these men to be remembered, properly remembered, their names added to memorials or headstones added to their graves, or in the case of the Bolton Wanderers footballer, for a grave to be dug for him and his name removed from one of the memorials for the missing. But these stories are all different. There are various reasons why these men's stories were forgotten about for so long. Their deaths were a tragedy, of course it was, but what happened to them after they died is just as bad. What we're going to do this week in the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, you see, we can put that wrong right and tell the stories of these men. And then hopefully they, along with everybody else that died in the Great War, will be remembered forevermore. That's the challenge that I have this week. So for our first story this week, we're going to head to Wellingborough in Northamptonshire, where we will find a new headstone that was dedicated recently to Gunner Arthur Herbert Furnell, and he was serving at the Royal Garrison Artillery Base Depot in Portsmouth in March 1918, when he died aged 34. So we're going to go over to the ceremony that I attended recently in the Doddington Road Cemetery in Wellingborough. There was a number of people there from the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, and there was a small service that was held in honour of Arthur. and I managed to record part of the ceremony.
So we're gathered in Wellingborough this morning in the Doddington Road Cemetery, where there are many scattered graves from both World Wars for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And we've come to commemorate a soldier who previously didn't have a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone. He's buried in a family plot with various other family members. And as I say, he's got a brand new headstone. There was nothing there previously. He's got the badge of the Royal Garrison Artillery on his headstone. There's no family inscription on the bottom. And it's beneath a tree, which has already been decorated by a bird.
It missed, and it missed because of people. People make administration mistakes, clerical errors. It's not recorded. It didn't get reported to the right people. And that's the story, really. They're a group, Infam the Cold, have you all heard of that? They're a group that really kind of research and look for people who've been missed and forgotten and try and get that recognition. Now, they have to jump through quite a lot of hoops to prove that an individual is deserving or should have had a Commonwealth War Grave headstone or a marker of some kind. But once they've done that and it goes through the commission, then, you know, that's a pretty good effort. And then, you know, something like this can happen. Now, Chris, who's our regional manager, could probably fill you in with more details and will have seen far more of these than I have.
So, I mean, really, what they want from the Infam the Cold group is they normally want a service record from them to prove that he was in uniform when he died or she died. They'll want the death record, the record of the certificate of death, and also they usually try and find something from the actual cemetery authorities or the church authorities to say that they are buried in that location. That's before we start to look at it. Then we'll do a site survey to find out if the grave is in fact marked, because quite often they are on a private memorial, in which case we just put a paper forward to the local authorities saying that that grave now has legal protection by law. And if it is unmarked, then we'll go through the local authorities to get permission to put a headstone up, and that's where we are now.
So I've got copies of lots of documents here, but actually the important bit which backs up what Chris has just said, the case officer's update on this were that the death certificate for Fennell Arthur Herbert shows that he died at number 6 Newcombe Road, Wellingborough, on the 8th of March 1918. The informant of the casualty's death was his widow, Ada Jane Fennell, and the location of the death was his home address. Now, for some reason, it was an unmarked grave. You don't know why, but the cemetery authority have confirmed the grave location at this one here, and they've annotated the cemetery plan. So that's where it went wrong, and this is where it's gone right.
And no, you couldn't trace any family? Does that have gone through that process, trace a family?
We would have done a next of kin appeal.
A short service, but we're also going to dedicate this headstone as well at the same time. You've got an order of service. And this is from Ecclesiasticus. The writer says, "Come, let us now praise famous men and our fathers that begat us. The Lord hath brought great glory by them through his great power from the beginning, such as did bear rule in their kingdoms. Men renowned for their power, giving counsel by their understanding and declaring prophecies. Leaders of the people by their counsels and by their knowledge of learning useful for the people. Wise and eloquent are their instructions. Such as found out musical tunes and recited verses in writing. Rich men furnished with ability, living peacefully in their habitations. All these were honoured in their generations and were the glory of their times. There be of them that have left a name behind them, that their praises might be reported. But some there be who have no memorial, who have perished as though they had never been born, and have become as though they had never been, and their children after them. But these were merciful men, whose righteousness had not been forgotten. With their seed shall remain a continuous good heritance, and their children are within the covenant. Their seed standeth fast, and their children for their sakes. Their seed shall remain forever, and their glory shall not be blotted out. Their bodies are buried in peace, but their name liveth forevermore. Amen. So let us pray. There is a response at the end. You can join in if you wish. Lord, our God, King of the universe, Lord of lords, the only ruler of princes, we thank you for bringing us here today to honour the memory of Gunnar Arthur Furnell and our fellow citizens who served in or supported the forces of the Crown in the fight for liberty and freedom. We thank you especially for shipmates who braved the seas, laying down their lives and crossed the bar to glory. For soldiers who, with their comrades in arms, resisted the enemy and made the ultimate sacrifice. For air personnel who conquered the skies, flew the heights, yet perished for all our sakes. And for those in support at home and abroad who lost their lives serving our families and nations, may they all rest in peace till we meet again.
Amen.
Father, we come here today to also dedicate this headstone for this young man. I think he was 31, but still young, leaving a widow behind. Some of us know exactly where New Common Road is, and it's good to know that a man who has been long forgotten is now remembered through the work of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, who have brought to the people of Wellingborough and elsewhere the attention of this particular gentleman, who, of course, scattered around across the whole of the cemetery here. I think there's something like 58, 60 other graves of similar, mainly young men. The chapel's 31. I pray, Lord, therefore, that as people come and look at this new headstone, they will not only remember him, but also will remember other men here buried in peace and at rest with you. So, Lord, we dedicate this headstone to your glory, and for the glory of all those who died and sacrificed their lives for us in the service of their country, and in particular for the service of the local people here. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Pray, Lord, that this headstone will stand here forever in memory of this particular gentleman. Thank you.
Now, I can tell you a little bit more about Arthur, because his service records are one of those that did survive the bombing of the building where the records were held in 1940. I think there's only about 20% of the records that still exist. And it tells us that he was one of the volunteers. He volunteered in February of 1915, completed his training, and then on the 9th of June 1916, he went out to the Somme battlefield with his unit of the Royal Garrison Artillery, and he served on the Somme battlefield until the 26th of September 1916, at which point he was transferred back home, and his record tells us that he had been gassed during the Battle of the Somme. And in February 1918, he was discharged from the army as being no longer fit for service, by which time, of course, the flu pandemic was sweeping the world, and he was already weak with the gas poisoning that he experienced 18 months before. And as we discussed in the cemetery, he did succumb to pneumonia. And we also know from his record that Arthur and his wife Ada had four children: Arthur, Constance, Agnes and Gladys. Arthur had been born in July 1905. So he would have been 13 when his father died. And the youngest, Gladys, had been born in 1909, and so she would have only been 9 years old. As always, you wonder what happened to Ada and the four children. And it's a shame they themselves will no longer be alive, but they must surely between them have descendants that are around, and maybe one day they'll go and see Arthur's grave in the Wellingborough Cemetery. This next story concerns a man that was considered missing for over 100 years, but his body was found in 2020. And just last week, he was finally buried in a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery. Second Lieutenant James Arthur Greenhall worked as a school teacher and he played football for Bolton Wanderers Football Club. He was an officer in the 1st Battalion of the Cheshires and he was buried with four military honours in a service that was arranged by the Ministry of Defence and the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. In the Guards Cemetery at Windy Corner, which is near Neuve Chapelle. This is a cemetery that was established during the First World War and was just behind the lines for most of the time during the conflict. Rosie Barron, who works for the JCCC, which is the Joint Casualty and Compassionate Centre of the MOD, she said it's been an honour to have worked with the Mercian Regiment, which today recruits from Cheshire, to organise the burial of 2nd Lieutenant Greenhall and these two unknown soldiers that were found and buried with him. Although two of these men were sadly not identifiable, the Greenhall family now have answers as to what happened to their relative, and he now rests in the Guards Cemetery alongside his comrades. The service was attended by members of the soldier's family and his great-niece, Joanna Potts. She was unable to attend, but said, "Hearing my great-uncle had finally been found after all this time has been an unexpected and surprisingly emotional time. We are so grateful that he will now be laid to rest and commemorated for the sacrifice he gave for us all." The coffin was carried through the cemetery by serving soldiers of the 1st Battalion, the Mercian Regiment, and the service was conducted by the Reverend Gary Birch, who's chaplain to the 19th Regiment of the Royal Artillery. He said, "I've officiated at a number of World War I burials of both known and unknown service personnel, and each one is special and important in their own right. Being able to honour them and finally show them the proper dignity and respect they deserve reminds me of the fragility of life and gives us an opportunity to pause, reflect and learn the lessons of past conflict." So who was James? Well, he was born in Bolton on the 5th of May 1889, one of four children born to Joseph and his wife Hannah. He began studying at Manchester University in 1907 and he obtained a BA in 1910 and also an MA in the study of oral and written historic sources. That came in 1912. And whilst he was doing this, he was a member of the Officer Training Corps at university. He became a classics master at Tame Grammar School before moving on to the grammar school in Ashton in Makerfield. And then just before the start of World War I, he was appointed as the secretary of the International Textile Institute. He was amateur footballer when he played for Bolton Wanderers. And then on the 6th of August 1914, so just after the start of the conflict, he was commissioned into the 1st Battalion of the Cheshires. And he joined his battalion in Birkenhead and arrived in France on the 7th of September 1914 and took part in the Battle of the Aisne and the fighting around Festubert. In those early weeks of the war, and on the 22nd of October 1914, at 5:30, in the morning, the enemy attacked the Cheshire's position on the outskirts of the village of Violaines. The alarm was raised by a patrol from D Company, but the trenches were rushed before they could resist, and bayonet fighting ensued. The entire battalion was forced to retire, with six officers and 209 other ranks missing, many of whom had been taken prisoner. And James was reported later to have been in the trenches, but was shot in the head. He was 25 years old. His men tried to recover him, but they couldn't because the enemy had captured the village. And a sergeant in the Norfolk Regiment who was serving with them was taken apparently by a German officer to the location where James was fallen and he was allowed to bury his body. But then after the wars, what often happened, especially with these deaths from early in the war, they couldn't find his grave and he was listed on the La Torre Memorial to the Missing. But in 2020, so 4 years ago now, it's taken 4 years for for this process to conclude, the remains of three soldiers were found on the outskirts of that village when they were building a new housing estate. Two of the officers didn't have any artifacts on them. One was believed to be an officer of the Cheshire Regiment. It's always easier to try and identify officers rather than other ranks because there's less of them. They can use the process of elimination. And they thought it might be James. So they contacted his family, who came forward for DNA testing, and it was indeed confirmed that finally, after 106 years, they'd found his body, and he was laid to rest in Windy Corner last week. And now we come to the story that I mentioned in the introduction of Hugh Williamson, a man that was added to the Teat Vale Memorial many years after he was killed. And the reason for that was because his parents, and his mother in particular, refused to accept that he died. He was the only child born in London of Hugh, who owned a colliery, and his wife Edith. On the 15th of September 1916, the Guards Division lost no fewer than 61 officers killed or mortally wounded in the struggle for the village of Le Boeufs. And his unit, the Coldstream Guards, suffered particularly severely, with their three battalions attacking in line. For the first time, 22 officers died, and amongst those casualties was Hugh, who disappeared during that battle. There's no doubt that he was killed on that day. It's just the circumstances that caused all the confusion and the stress for his poor parents back at home. And what made them think that he'd survived was the contradictory eyewitness accounts of his death. At first, they accepted that he died, and they began the process of winding up his financial affairs. There was a Lieutenant Arthur Newland, and he told the Williamsons that their son had been sniped on the battlefield and killed instantaneously, and he was buried where he fell. Newland couldn't remember exactly where that was, so immediately they started to become suspicious. But then they'd received a telegram from the MOD, from the War Office, saying that their son had died on the 16th, when in fact he died the day before. So you can see why they'd become suspicious, couldn't you? You'd cling on to anything, wouldn't you, to hope that your boy was still alive. So having heard about this story and seen his name on the Teat Vale Memorial, I decided to go down to Kew and retrieve the officer's file, which have never been digitised. They're still there, and they weren't destroyed in the Second World War like so many of the other ranks files had been. And some of the documents that I found in his file make fascinating reading. There are so many accounts of how he died, and they're quite right. A lot of them are contradictory. For example, there's one here from a Private Smith, which is dated October 1919, so 3 years after he died. And he writes to the family, he says, "I beg to inform you about Lieutenant Williamson that on the day of the 15th of September 1916, I saw him killed by a hand grenade in the early part of the morning. Williamson was my platoon officer. He died in front of Le Boeufs. I was just behind him, but what became of him after, I could not say." Another typed account in the file says, "I was quite near Lieutenant Williamson in the attack at Le Boeufs on September the 15th and 16th. He was hit in the heart and chest by three machine gun bullets and died instantly. He was carried to the rear and received a proper burial. I had to go on, so could not say where he was buried." He even gives a description of him. He says he was a tall, slight man, pale complexion and dark hair. And then another man who was in hospital in Etaples, Sergeant Simcox, he gave some evidence as to who the burial officer was, the man that buried him. He said he was killed in front of Le Boeufs on the 15th in the charge. "I know some of the stretcher bearers who buried his body. One of them is Private D. Harding. He's still with the battalion. He spoke to me about having helped." Understandably, the family really hung on to this. They've now got a name of someone who buried their son. Could this give them the closure that they've been looking for? Now, Harding survived the war, and in 1919 he was tracked down as working at a police station in Manchester. And he gave a written statement which really did crush any hope of the body being found, or indeed Williamson being still alive. Because Daniel Harding says the lieutenant was killed during the advance on Le Boeufs about 7 a.m. while advancing with his company. He was walking round a shell hole when he was shot through the head by a German sniper. Afterwards, his body was blown to pieces by a shell that exploded in the ground where the body was, leaving no trace of him. I witness this occurrence. But then, on the 8th of January 1919, another man, a Sergeant F. Andrews of the same battalion, he wrote to Mrs. Williamson and said this: "I venture to say with deep regret that I'm unable to give any information regarding your son in spite of many inquiries. Your son, who was so very much liked by myself and my fellow comrades of his platoon, was most unfortunately taken prisoner, together with myself and several more. All were separated with the exception of myself and my friend, and after 2 days had elapsed, we managed to escape and reach our own lines in safety. The whereabouts of the remainder of those taken prisoner, I regret to say, I do not know. Should I at any time gather information, I shall be greatly pleased to forward same to you with all speed. I hope and trust that you will receive word that your son is quite well, or even better, that you will receive your son in person." Now that, of course, renewed their hope that he hadn't been killed. They wouldn't now believe the previous account that he'd been blown up or sniped or shot by machine gun bullets. Now they'd got some evidence from Andrews that he was perhaps still alive and in a prisoner of war camp, even though this is nearly 3 years after he'd been reported killed. Could it be, like so many other people thought, that he'd lost his memory and that he was in a prisoner of war camp? And they then read an article in a newspaper published in Liverpool that gave even more substance to their theories. The article talks about a Frenchman that had reportedly returned home years after he was captured. And it says, "Indisputable proof that Germany, in spite of repeated assurances to the contrary, is still secretly retaining Allied soldiers as prisoners of war." And this has been confirmed by the return home of a French soldier who has just escaped from their hands. The soldier, who was 24 years of age, was taken prisoner in 1916, and since that date has been refused all means of communication with his friends. A few days ago, he succeeded in escaping from a prison where he was confined, and yesterday he reached his home. His appearance had changed by the hardships that he'd undergone. No one in his native village recognised him until he explained who he was. He has the aspect of an old man. He gives frightful details of the cruelties still being inflicted on Allied prisoners by the Germans, and states emphatically that other men are still detained by the Boche. These men, he says, are shut up underground in underground prisons and are given the scantiest possible amount of food once every 2 days. His statements have created a sensation in France, where hundreds of families are still mourning the fate of the men who are reported to have been taken prisoners and who, on the German denial of all knowledge of them, have been returned as missing. This newspaper is calling for immediate action by the Allied Supreme. It is suggested that, assuming this soldier's story to be correct, it's very possible that many British and other Allied soldiers, as well as French, are enduring similar sufferings. Now, we can't confirm or deny the story of that French soldier. We haven't got any information to enable us to do that. But what we do now know is that there wasn't hundreds of thousands or many, if any, soldiers at all that were still being kept prisoner by the Germans. It was one of those things that people wanted to believe as an explanation as to why their menfolk had not returned, that they were missing, that they were dead, and in so many cases that their graves would never be found. It's difficult to accept, isn't it? Parents sent that article to the War Office and they replied, and said that there's no doubt that Lieutenant Williamson was killed on the 15th of September 1916. He was so reported, it says, by his commanding officer, and this report would not have been made without sufficient grounds. And this report is confirmed by the statements made to you by Second Lieutenant Newland and quoted by you in previous correspondence. It's also confirmed by statements made to the British Red Cross Society by two soldiers of the regiment that he was killed. It is also outside of all experiences that an officer can survive when no news of him has been received over so long a period. In regards to the statement of Sergeant Andrews that saw him being taken prisoner, it is the fact that many officers and men have been taken prisoner but have fallen soon afterwards from shell fire. It is regretted that it is not possible to locate his grave or recover his disc, but in the circumstances of the modern battlefield, this is very frequently impossible. While sympathising with your distress in the loss of this gallant officer, the Army Council regret that they can hold out to you no hope that he has survived. Now, 18 months later, the family still wouldn't accept it and they've written back to the War Office again, still not believing the information they've received from either the War Office or from the other eyewitness accounts. So on the 7th of October 1920, so now 4 years after he's died, the War Office writes again to Mrs. Williamson, Edith, and they say, "I'm directed to inform you that in the knowledge of this office, there are no officers or men of the Imperial Army under care for mental trouble who are unidentified and whose location and condition are unknown to their relatives. I'm also to state that it is considered that you are encouraging a vain hope in supposing that your son might still be alive in Germany. Shortly after the conclusion of hostilities, a systematic search was conducted in Germany for British prisoners of war who might have been isolated at the time of the general repatriation, and it is not believed that any British soldiers are now being detained in that country against their will. Had any been overlooked in this search, it is unlikely that they would have escaped the notice of the various missions which have since been continuously operating there. It is regretted that no hope can be held out that Lieutenant Wilson is now alive and unidentified. You may be assured that should the place of his burial yet be discovered, you will be duly notified, although it must be remembered that in the locality in which your son is reported to have met his death, heavy fighting subsequently occurred, and all traces of many graves were in subsequence destroyed. I am again to express the sympathy of the Army Council with you in your loss." There are some quite harsh words there, but of course Germany was occupied by the Allied forces in the period after the war, and had there been any British soldiers in mental institutions or being kept against their will, as the letter said, they would have been found. Edith was never to give up, ever. She wrote, "I shall never believe that my son is dead until his grave is found, and it adds greatly to the sorrow of his father and me that we should be left in this awful state of uncertainty." So they weren't the only ones, were they? It was, what, 500,000 British and Allied soldiers in the same situation. What had happened to their son? Where was he? It's a story, a thought that both his parents and so many others would take to their own graves. Now, these people, as I said, they never gave up, and they even took their search to the battlefields of France. In the autumn of 1920, they travelled out to France. They scoured the hospitals in the Somme area. They were hoping that they'd find their boy suffering from a loss of memory. They visited some of the new cemeteries that were beginning to spring up on the battlefield. But then Mrs. Williamson saw that the Portland headstones had been erected. She wanted to see Christian crosses there. This is a subject that is that we'd have to cover in a separate podcast, really. And she wrote that she hopes that their son, in her words, is not buried in any of your pagan cemeteries. She believed that England's heroes were being buried like dogs. This is all because there weren't Christian crosses there like the French had got. Still didn't bring closure whatsoever. And then in 1937, Mr. Williamson died 21 years after his son had been reported missing. And in 1932, when the Teat Vale Memorial was unveiled, Hugh's name was missing. Because as far as Edith was concerned, he wasn't missing, he wasn't even dead, he was still alive somewhere. And Edith herself died in 1952, and her son's name was still not on the war memorial at Teat Vale. It was only added as late as 2001, which is why he's listed not on the main structure, but on the addendum at the back. As you'd expect, Hugh Senior and Edith are buried together. And on their headstone, Hugh is listed as well. It says he was born on the 20th of November 1894, but it doesn't say he's died. It says missing since the Battle of the Somme, 15th of September 1916. 1st Battalion, Coldstream Guards. You see, so many of these family graves throughout the United Kingdom where the parents and other family members are buried, and quite often it will say also in memory of such and such a soldier killed in the Battle of the Somme, Arras, Passchendaele. Not this one. It doesn't mention that he's died at all. It says that he's missing. Now, as I speak, on the Saturday morning, the 25th of May, over at Newfoundland Park, there's a very special memorial taking place. And it's all to do with another unknown warrior, another soldier that's been buried beneath a headstone that says known unto God for over 100 years. And this particular soldier is an unknown warrior from Newfoundland, which is now part of Canada. We've covered the story in previous podcasts about the Newfoundland Regiment attack against the Germans at Beaumont Hamel. In the year 2000, the Canadian unknown warrior was returned to Ottawa and is now buried inside the Canadian tomb of the unknown soldier at their National War Memorial. But it was felt that Newfoundland should have their own unknown warrior in their capital city of St. John's, because in 1916, Newfoundland was an independent country. It wasn't part of Canada until 1949. Now, as with other nations, Newfoundland's unknown warrior has been exhumed from a cemetery, a Commonwealth War Graves cemetery in northern France, and he'll be reinterred in a specially designed tomb at the National War Memorial in St. John's. And he will represent all of the Newfoundlanders and the who served in all branches of the military during the First World War. A fallen soldier will symbolically honour those men that died before the province became part of Canada in 1949. Frank Sullivan is from the Royal Canadian Legion and in Newfoundland, and he said, in 1919, Private Thomas Nangle of the Royal Newfoundland Regiment had a vision, a dream of a national war memorial in St. John's to remember our fallen. Work commenced in 1919, and during this time, he requested the repatriation of an unknown soldier to be part of the memorial. Now, this request was never actioned, and with this approval to repatriate an unknown soldier, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission for rededication in 2024, his vision, his dream will be complete. And Claire Horton, who's the Director General of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, said, "We are proud to have been able to facilitate this exceptional step for the repatriation of a Newfoundland soldier from the Western Front, who, though unknown, represents the collective contribution and sacrifice of all those who lost their lives in conflict from Newfoundland and Labrador for the freedoms we all enjoy today." Now, as part of this process, as I said, today, the 25th of May, there was a special ceremony at Newfoundland Park on the Somme, and then a military aircraft is being used to fly the unknown warrior to St. John's International Airport. And it will be a historic homecoming for him, fell in battle and was buried in an unknown grave. When it arrives in St. John's, there'll be a brief ceremony at the side of the airport. The casket will be placed into a hearse and taken on a route that includes a drive past of landmarks with significant historical notes to the Newfoundland participation in the war. One of the places that they'll pass will be a camp where most of the soldiers trained, and it will also pass the war memorial in downtown St John's, and the remains will then be placed in a secure location. And then between June the 28th and the 30th, it will lie in state in the Confederation Building, and members of the public will be able to pass and pay their respects, just as they did in 1920 at the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior in Westminster Abbey. And then on the 1st of July, the soldiers' remains will be reinterred inside a newly constructed granite burial chamber. And as a reminder, more than 12,000 men from Newfoundland served in the military or the support services during the First World War. 1,700 of those lost their lives, and 800 of them still have no known grave. 600 of those unknown graves are located in France and Belgium, marked with those words of Kipling, "known unto God." Now, one of those that has no known grave is a man called Frederick White, and he came from a place in Newfoundland called Twillingate. He was killed where Newfoundland Park is now on the 1st of July 1916. And his granddaughter is called Eleanor, and she told the CBC News in Canada that the remains could be those of her grandfather. She said, "There's something about the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier that brings tears. It brings tears because of the sacrifice they made and the families that were shattered. It's a bittersweet honour. Whoever it is, it's still a great honour." Now, as most people will know, last week was the Commonwealth War Graves Commission War Graves Week, and there was something like 160 different locations in the UK alone. And volunteers of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, like myself, guided people around these cemeteries telling the stories of the men and women that are buried within the United Kingdom. And I did five of those tours last week. Two of them on Saturday and Sunday were in a place called Dallington Cemetery. It's the first time I'd taken people around this particular cemetery. And as we were going around, we were telling normal stories and people were telling me their stories. And then we came across a brand new headstone that had only been placed there recently by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And the only information that we had about Hubert Atherton of the Middlesex Regiment is that he had died in May of 1916. But that only tells half the story. His death had never been noted by the commission. It had been missed off the records. We don't know why. It was a clerical error, no doubt. And all that was there was a small grave marker with a number on it. There was no headstone, but now there is. But his story is absolutely tragic, and it just shows the fear and anxieties that must have been prevalent in 1916, the middle of the First World War. This young man in Northampton was 24 years old. He'd seen lots of the wounded come back to the town from the battles of 1914 at Mons, and certainly in 1915 at Loos, at Neuve Chapelle, at Ubers Ridge. Listeners of this podcast will know how badly the Northamptonshire men suffered. And by this time, there was already several hospitals in the town, and men were coming to Northampton from all of the battlefields on the Western Front and even beyond, even Gallipoli, where they were treated and unfortunately sometimes died of their wounds. And this would have been the environment that young Hubert was growing up in. And there was also the fear, if he didn't volunteer, that somebody was going to give you a feather in the street, a white feather, and bring shame on you and your family. But he didn't volunteer, did Hubert. But in 1916, conscription was brought in, and he wasn't married, and therefore he was one of the first to be ordered to join up, and he was posted to the Middlesex Regiment. But he never, ever got anywhere near the battlefield. How do we know? Because I have in front of me a newspaper article from the Northampton local newspaper, which is dated the 5th of May 1916. There's lots of stories on the page that tell us how the town of Northampton is contributing to the war effort. Lots of photographs of people growing their own crops and working in the munitions factories. And then, of course, there's dozens of memorials to soldiers that died on the Western Front, or those that have been wounded, and some men have been promoted to officers, and that's been announced in the local paper. But tragically, on the right-hand side of the page, the article is entitled 4 Days Service, a Northampton Soldier's Suicide. And this is indeed the story of Hubert Atherton. The borough coroner held an inquest at the town hall on Thursday on the body of Hubert Atherton, 24 years old, a private in the Middlesex Regiment, whose body was found in the River Nene at Northampton on Tuesday. Louis Atherton, coaching foreman on the railways and living at number 12, Western Terrace, identified the body of his son. He joined the army on the 17th of April and was billeted at home. He slept at home 3 nights, and the last time the witness saw him alive was on Thursday, April the 20th. He'd been worried about having to go into the army, and he'd been unable to sleep. On one occasion, he said that the army would not see much of him, but the witness, his father, did not anticipate that he contemplated suicide. He'd been very quiet and depressed, but beyond the worry of becoming a soldier, he had no trouble. An officer of the Middlesex Regiment stated that the last time Atherton paraded was on April the 20th. Lance Corporal Harry Jarvis, who was billeted in St Edmunds Road in Northampton, said he was in Midsummer Meadow on Tuesday afternoon when a boatman called his attention to the body of a soldier in the river. The witness pulled the body to the bank and a police officer assisted him to get him out of the water. PC Arthur Clipston said he found on the body a cigarette case and a leather wallet containing the card bearing the name of a man of the Royal Sussex Regiment, and Atherton's cap had not been found. The coroner said he'd known Atherton and his father for some years, and he was sure the jury would join him in expressing deep sympathy with the father and the relatives on the sad circumstances of this case. And the jury returned a verdict of suicide due to temporary insanity and associated themselves with the remarks of the coroner. So you may ask, how comes he has a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone even at this late stage? Well, he's entitled to one, that's why. Under the rules of the commission that were laid down in 1917, if a man was in uniform and he served between the years of 1914 and 1921, which was the cut-off date, 31st of August 1921, then whatever the circumstances, however long or however short time he served, if he died in service, then he would be entitled to a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone. And we'll never know the reason why he didn't get one at the time. Maybe his father was ashamed, I don't know. Maybe he was too upset to apply for one, if that indeed was the process then, I don't know. But he wasn't registered on the Commission's website either. But he is now. That wrong has been righted. And last week, over Saturday and Sunday, I explained to about 40 people the story of Hubert Atherton. And now his story goes round the world as we talk about him on this podcast. It's only right, isn't it, that we remember each and every casualty of the Great War. They were all victims if they died, whatever the circumstances. So there we go, just a few examples of how for many, many years these men were forgotten about. They'd been missed off the records. Nobody had recorded their deaths. But now they have. Now they have a place amongst the fallen, amongst the heroes of the Great War. How many more are out there? Well, I've got two more, because when I was going through some archives in the Northampton Library a few weeks ago, I came across the story of two soldiers whose obituary was in the newspaper, but when I searched the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website, there's no record of them at all. And I'm now going through the process of putting together a file which I can send to the Commission, and hopefully one day these two men will also be recorded on the Commission's website. They'll also have a headstone above their grave, and people will be able to go and see their graves, just as they can go and see the graves of all these other men and women that have died in service during both world wars and that are commemorated by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. So thank you very much again for tuning in to the podcast. I'm very grateful, otherwise I'd be sitting here talking to myself, wouldn't I? And as usual, we'll end the podcast by playing the last post in memory of all of those forgotten soldiers, in a way that are now no longer forgotten, that we talked about in this week's podcast.